I'm just going to start with a few general remarks. The bulk, however, of this session later on will be to give a lecture on the notion of flow. And before that, we'll discuss your critiquing of the wikis. But first of all, those of you in Group 19 may recognise the name. Siobhan Lynch is a researcher who's doing some work on mindfulness meditation and its benefits for students. And I was chatting on the phone last night when I should have been preparing this lecture. And one of the things that came out of that we found ourselves talking about is the following, actually. I just want to lodge in your mind. But because she's evaluated her courses, one of the things she mentioned was that typically students who'd done the course, when she asked them whether they felt it had made a difference, they say, oh, no, it doesn't make a difference. And then she gets them to talk a bit more, and they say, well, I suppose I do argue with my boyfriend less, and it's true, I don't seem to have the same trouble with insomnia. And they go on listing these things. So it's as if they weren't aware of a change, but actually it seems there is one there. Now, I found that very interesting, because some years ago I happened to read a paper by a very serious psychoanalyst who discussed what, in effect, is a similar problem with psychoanalysis. So, if a therapist were to come across or to recontact a patient 5 years later, some of them will express enormous gratitude about how their life was transformed and so on, and others will, of course, they remember therapy because they had to pay for it, but they won't have any particular memory of it. Now, this psychotherapist was saying that if you're serious about the therapeutic process, then actually it's the ones who barely remember it are the ones you've healed over completely and no longer remember that trauma, and that those who are still desperately grateful and regard this as somehow a landmark in their life, it's probably a sign of someone who's permanently broken in some way that the therapist hasn't really got over. Now, that's obviously a tricky problem when thinking about evidence for some positive psychology techniques like mindfulness, where you hope you're talking about a healthy population and you hope they're even more healthy afterwards, but some of the obvious measures might, in fact, not necessarily work. So you might want to bear that in mind when reading papers in positive psychology. One interesting thing always is to think about their outcome measures and what they look like. So although clearly measuring questionnaire measures of happiness and so on seems the obvious thing to do, still real well-being might not be being particularly conscious of happiness. It might be the absence of other things, problems going away, things that used to worry them don't worry them so much, in which case you have to look for other measures. So I was particularly interested in the gratitude study that used visits to the local health centre as a measure, which I'm sure the students weren't thinking about this was going to be a measure, but it's actually an indirect measure of having an effect that the patient probably isn't conscious of. After all, people get ill, see the doctor intermittently, don't very often have a big conscious concept about moving from a massively ill to a massively healthy epoch in their life. I also think that there's some similar issue in education, because although some educationalists, like in a class like this, they'll ask everyone to think of a particularly good teacher, they'll think about events, and most of us can remember some events, actually most of us, I think, have very little memory of where we learned. After all, if your mind's caught up in learning, why would you remember the event? Most of us can't do two processing sets of processing at once. Or look at it another way. For those of you who are native English speakers and educated, you've probably got a vocabulary of about 30,000 English words. How many of those 30,000 words can you remember when and where you learned it? And yet learning a word seems almost the most superficial kind of learning. Actually, we don't. So that So I mentioned this in two things. One is to just drop a little critical thought on you when you're looking at outcome measures and whether they're sufficiently sophisticated. And the other, because of course it does relate in a way to consciousness. That is, we like to think we're conscious. Most of us have thoughts we are conscious of buzzing around. But if you're a sophisticated psychologist, you should be way over the point where you think the bits you can introspect about are necessarily most or the important bits of what's actually going on. That's today's thought for the day. So I'm going to give a rather personal and idiosyncratic talk about flow. Even Seligman acknowledges Csikszentmihalyi as the founder of positive psychology. Csikszentmihalyi, I think that's pronounced right, Hungarian name, but his academic career that we know about was in the States, defined this topic really in terms of consciousness, or at least interacting with that. So Csikszentmihalyi's question to himself when he began this work was, there's all this psychology about, you know, people being mentally ill and so on. I'd like to do research on the extreme opposite. So what's the optimal experiences, he says? What's the most enjoyable mental functioning anybody experiences? And can I begin to characterize it? So he did interview studies. The first one, I believe, was on sculptors working in New York City. So he'd interview them about the bit of their life they valued the most, which was typically losing themselves and doing sculpture, and accumulated these descriptions of what that is like. And I think it works as a topic exactly what it says at the bottom of the slide, that is, that the kind of reports you get are very similar, or at least similar enough to feel that this is not, you know, idiosyncratic experience. Of course, part of the nuisance for you as students is that this stuff is mostly in books, not journals, so you actually have to move your legs and go to the library. Which I know students think is just so last century. The show-off student will spell his name correctly in exam answers. Everyone else will say MC, and I'll know what you mean, especially if you've got the word flow within a word or two of it. So it's an attempt to describe the mental state humans most value, which is to do, it emerges from his interview, with being fully absorbed in an activity. And the word flow he picked because it was a metaphor used by one of his participants. Right. Of course, those who think positive psychology is a cheap and nasty rebranding of a perfectly good traditional subject will say, this is really Maslow's, what do you call it, self-actualization. I've never understood quite what self-actualization means, unless it really means flow, but Maslow couldn't get around to describing it. Right. So here are some of the... I'll do an impressionistic sort of description of what the sculptors in the sample would report, which is... typically they get into making the sculpture. While they were doing it, they'd be doing things almost continuously, although probably with moments of looking at it. But really, there wouldn't be breaks. There'd be none of this staring out the library window wondering if you can have dinner yet, or staring out the library window wondering how you can actually do the next step because you can't think how to do the next step in the mass equation. It was involving, it was continuous activity. They'd be typically they'd lose track of time, so they wouldn't be aware of time while they're acting. They talk about loss of self, but they also feel, and this might be a really central feature, feel control over the situation. breaking that down, there's a clear expectation of goals and immediate feedback. So if you're moulding about a head of someone in plasticine or something, you're getting feedback through your fingers and through your eyes. Every little movement you make is reflected by a change in the plasticine. You immediately see the result. It's very immediate. Completely focused on the task and no leftover attention. Now, probably there are quite a bit, few bits of your life that are like this, in fact, but there's almost a paradox, because in the sense that people in the middle of flow, in Csikszentmihalyi's version of the concept, they not only become unaware, that is unconscious of everything around them other than the task, but I'm not sure that they actually, there's an interesting question about to what extent would you say they're conscious of what they're doing. And I think that's because it's a bit like when I pace up and down here. I'm actually using my eyes. I won't trip over things provided my eyes are looking in the right direction. But if you wait 5 seconds and ask me how many steps I took, I'm unlikely to be able to report that. And that's actually characteristic of a lot of human functioning. You know, you do it, it passes through your mind. If you interrupt someone and ask them what they were doing at that exact moment, they can report it. So it's not unconscious in the normal sense, but it doesn't get into memory. It doesn't stay in memory. And of course, some of our intuitive ideas about consciousness are things that you're aware of and remain aware of and give an account of. And yet, a lot of this, it's not. They're in the flow and it's gone. At the end of the experience, it's almost entirely gone, and what's left is the product. Now, there's one defining feature that distinguishes Csikszentmihalyi's definition of flow from other versions I'm going to give, and that is that it's not only absorbing and continuous, but it is highly congruent or consonant with that person's values. So for a sculptor, it's developing a sculpture, a new sculpture that they think is original and interesting. Whereas a lot of things we get lost in can be trivial tasks. But in Csikszentmihalyi's view, it's being in flow, doing what you think is actually the most important thing you value most in life, pretty much. Now, on the other hand, there's lots of things that satisfy all the criteria except being associated with something you regard as important to your values in life, called here microflow. So, you know, laugh and joke with people at a party and you probably don't remember most of what you say. Browsing the shops, don't remember much afterwards. Visit galleries. Sexual activity is quite a good one, especially for married people. They say it's valuable, but most of them wouldn't be able to fill in a diary of how often they'd had sex with any accuracy afterwards. And they wouldn't be able to say, 3 seconds on, 5 minutes in. Again, it's absorbing. It's usually valued. Doesn't seem to leave much of a memory trace in many senses. So there are all kinds of areas of which that's true in this microflow sense. Why have I got that there? Right. Now, I think actually flow, apart from the value part of it, is quite common in our lives, and we always like it, and a number of phenomena follow from that. And that the way I would define flow is it's a state where at every state in the stage in the task, it's not you know what you'll do next. You look at it, you do the next. So, you know, you're rereading your essay, you notice a typo, you fix it. You don't make a plan about typo, you don't go through and list the typos and then go through and correct them, you react to it, go on to the next one. You always know what to do next. You're never stumped for a suggestion, nor worried about having to choose between them. In other words, there are two kinds of ways in which we can operate, but don't enjoy it so much. One is you're stumped. You just don't know what to do. You know it's important, but you don't know what to do. You come to a fork in the path. Which way is the right way? You need to solve a math problem, but you don't have any of the techniques in your head that seem to be necessary. You're stumped. And the other is, there are several ways, like several paths there, but you don't know how to choose between them. And these are both, we experience them as problems, basically, as opposed to flow. Now, it doesn't actually follow that when you do feel you know what to do next and go with it, it's enjoyable. It doesn't actually mean you're doing it optimally. You might, in fact, be using quite an inefficient method. You might be walking the long way round, but on a path that's very familiar to you. Flow may be efficient, but it's nothing guaranteed about that. But it doesn't feel like a problem, because you don't have to stop and think. And again, I think that's an interesting thing with respect to consciousness. Sarah may rudely interrupt and contradict me, but Heidegger is said to have said, argued to the effect that the whole point of consciousness is to deal with problems, and that a happily functioning human is one who actually isn't alert, awake, and thinking about things, because they're in flow and can do things. Is that roughly right?
Yep, I think so.
Yeah. So Heidegger's take on consciousness is that it, far from being, well, you might try and make an argument that's a defining feature of humans, but actually humans are happiest when they're not conscious. They're actually succeeding without having to think, and that thinking is for fixing problems, not for getting on with stuff you are competent at and enjoy. I first, for rather different reasons than this course, became interested in flow because I used to do research in human-computer interaction. And actually, it's quite, these remarks apply quite well to whether you've got the user interface to something like Moodle right or not, is whether, or whether you've designed your wiki page right or not, is whether people who've got a question in their head can just stare through the screen and go to where they want, or do they stop and have to think about a problem when the problem they really want to solve is over there, but they have to worry about the damn tool getting in the way. And it's just like Heidegger says, there's an impasse, and your consciousness is forcibly derailed and forced to focus on something that you don't want to, that's just a means to an end, as opposed, as it were, to looking through the screen and operating on words and being derailed by the interface. You have to think about command, you have to think what your fingers are doing when we're trying to do a word processing problem. So it's also about a good user interface is one where the user's focus and flow is in the work domain, and a bad interface is where it derails you and you have to solve problems about how to use a bloody machine instead of solving the work problems that are what you're trying to focus on. Now, there are several aspects hiding under there. There's another topic in positive psychology that you could read up about, usually called the burden of choice, which is about how humans respond to having a lot of choices. And, of course, Western ideology tends to say that consumer choice is a good thing. Actually, it turns out that you might feel more in control if you've got a choice between six, but if I could give you a choice between 20 different kinds of jam in a shop, you end up buying none of them and not feeling very satisfied. So with choice comes forced processing and a bit of annoyance about how am I supposed to make this choice, and so on. And that's one thing that's been looked at in one area of positive psychology that can be clearly flow is somehow related to that. Another is you may have come across this, though I'm not sure under what keywords, maybe in your first year doing psychology, and that is that people like some sort of level of challenge, and if it's too easy, you feel bored. Dislike it because it's too easy. If it's too hard, you dislike it because you don't feel in control and can't make progress. And people typically like some sweet point in between. But it's not an absolute sweet point. It's actually a function of how alert, how aroused you are. So if you think about, if I wake you up in the middle of the night, you will not be up for a complicated problem. You'll barely be able to solve a very ordinary one. Now, we're kind of used to sleep-wake patterns, but I became a bit more aware of the effect my varying levels of arousal come, because if I try and watch a documentary, which I really like, but try and watch it after, say, 10 at night, I actually doze off. It's soothing and it doesn't go in, doesn't keep me awake. Whereas a fifth rerun of a Clint Eastwood film probably will, even though it's shameful to admit it, because it can be processed with actually not many mental resources. On the other hand, if I wake up on a holiday and say, I'm damned if I'm going to think about anything academic today, turn on a Clint Eastwood film, I'm just bored within minutes. A documentary might do it, but an older film won't. So the sweet spot is somewhere between too hard and too easy, but it depends on how much energy you've got at that moment. If you go into a bit more detail on the burden of choice, there's actually two kinds of mental strategies. One is about maximising, that is, trying to find the one choice that's best. But as the number of alternatives goes up, that would remain the optimal problem as defined by whether you choose the best, but it won't be optimal when you take into account the costs of doing the processing and getting the information. And satisficing is a word Herb Simon, who got a Nobel Prize for economics, so you have to be respectful. Satisficing was his term for making a choice without bothering to be sure it's the absolute best, it's just good enough. And that's more appropriate when you've got far too many alternatives to process in depth, but will nevertheless get you something that won't cost you very much, if cost is measured as the difference between the absolute best and the one you pick. So here's some idealized graphs illustrating some of these. So when I was talking about arousal, sometimes in psychology textbooks called the Yerkes-Dodson law, so performance is vertical, so higher up the graph is you're doing it better. Over to the right is arousal. But it depends on the nature of the task. So the one on the right is probably a task like running for your life. And the more aroused you are, the faster you run until you really are in the last stages of panic. On the other hand, if it's not running but getting out of a building, picking the right door, not pushing on a door that needs to be pulled, not running to the basement when the exit's on the ground floor, that requires a bit more cognitive processing. And total very high arousal will actually damage your performance on that, so task one would be better done at slightly lower levels, but they're all done badly at very low levels of arousal. So you've only got to think about what it's like if you're woken in the middle of the night and required to do something. You're not going to perform very well, you won't run fast, you probably won't even get your feet in your shoes very fast. This graph looks at two other dimensions about how hard the task is, challenge, going up the way, and skill that you as an individual have for that particular task. And flow is most likely going to be along the diagonal. And if you're below the diagonal, you're bored because your skill exceeds the challenge. If you're above the diagonal, you'll be anxious because you don't have enough skill to meet that challenge. Now, for all the aspects of flow except its congruence with your values, there are a lot of different activities. One can even try and make a distinction between relatively passive flow, because you have to think about how TV manages to act as a tranquilizer on nearly everyone, from quite young infants to old people with significant senility. It's such a universally useful tranquilizer. That's why they have it on in airports and all the other places. But how does it work, given the rather low quality of what's displayed? The fact is, it does somehow engage your brain in a low way that's just enough to occupy it. For instance, there have been studies which claim to explain the obesity epidemic in children to some extent by doing observational studies which show that when watching TV, a child actually literally moves less than when they're sitting doing anything else at all. So it's not a question of the difference between sitting and running around. Sitting reading a book, children are typically twisting and being, you know, restless like you are here, yawning a bit but actually moving your limbs, you know, over and over again in little ways. TV, people become significantly more immobile. But flow also can be applied to many active tasks. Now, I want to suggest further definitions distinguishing, say, unconscious, conscious, and Csikszentmihalyi style flow. So unconscious flow would be like walking or driving to work, but thinking of other things. So most people have had an experience where they have a familiar commute by any mode of arriving at work or arriving at home at the end of the day, and they can't actually remember anything from the journey because it's so familiar and they weren't thinking about it. And yet their brain was processing in a way. They'd have, you know, walked into lampposts and stuff if they hadn't been processing, but it didn't require any consciousness. They were actually thinking about other things. So there's a kind of flow that seems not to occupy consciousness. So the contrast would be, you're making that same commute, but this time you're late or anxious in some way. And you may, in fact, not be moving very much faster. After all, you've only got to drive about 5 or 10 miles an hour faster than you usually do to be constantly anxious about hitting cars and avoiding things. And so you'll be extremely aware of the driving task. It will completely absorb your mental processing, even though it's flow another kind that you know at each moment what to do and so on. So what looks to an outside observer as almost the same task, that is a routine journey, can be either done more or less without any consciousness, in the sense of you're able to use your consciousness to think about something else, or it can be done completely recruiting consciousness to do it. But what distinguishes Csikszentmihalyi flow is, above all, the activity is valuable to the things you think are most important in life. So one way of thinking about good user interface design, whether it's for a wiki page or for a piece of software or computer game, is you want to support flow in the user, but flow of the right kind. So ideally you'd achieve unconscious flow for the use of the controls, but the conscious flow would be in the work itself. Of course, if you haven't worked in the field, you can perhaps not fully realise how much an activity can move from one to the other. So I'm old enough to have run a study an undisclosed number of years ago, but in this university, where I managed to get a student who was truly a naive user and hadn't ever used a mouse, and he understood it was a pointing device, but he did things like pick it up, try and use it like a remote control, and so on. And these seem ludicrous to us because we've so internalized that skill. Actually, when you think about it, it's not at all obvious. Why should movement to and fro on this flat surface mean movement up and down on a vertical screen? Might as well be the other way around. It's only a convention. You see what I mean? This kind of thing is... can be a problem when you first see it, but after a bit it can completely fade away and not recruit resources associated with consciousness. And it's particularly clear in the area of user interfaces some of the conditions that really help. That is, it really helps seeing the mouse cursor move for every little movement of the mouse. It really helps in today's word processors where every letter you type immediately appears on the screen. And if it doesn't, you know you've done something wrong. That instant feedback, which is true of us doing physical movements like this, but isn't true of a lot of other things. So when you're writing text, you don't have another reader there. You are having to use your brain such a lot because you're trying to create sentences that are going to work for a stranger in another context with a different set of knowledge, and you can't test any of it out. You have to write thousands of words before it gets its first test. That is not an activity designed for flow, or at least not easily. That is, your activity as the author isn't it's much harder to achieve flow there. The importance of undo is that in most computer tasks nowadays have been designed to have an undo, which means you don't, there's low penalties for making mistakes. So what a difference that is to, say, sawing a piece of wood, where each stroke of the saw does something you can never undo. You know, it destroys that piece of wood. The gash is going to be there, and it's going to be that depth, and there's no undoing that beyond buying a new piece of wood and redoing all the previous work on this piece of wood. And so it's penalties for your choices are a powerful way to make it unlikely you can afford to operate in flow in a particular task. In fact, I once, a long time ago now, taught a course on HCI, and one of the, it's for external people, and one of them was an officer from the Air Force. And he actually didn't start any of the activities at first, so we went around and asked him why. And that was because, as he politely pointed out, learning by making errors leads to a short and bad life in aircraft. And it's a tactic that is completely selected out of pilots, or at least meant to be. So this makes cognitive life much easier, but it isn't a fact about the world, it's a fact about some special environments. Another aspect of flow you don't see talked about much, but which you can observe if you start observing your own actions closely enough, is that one might think that if you do something again and again and again, you're going to adopt a fixed procedure, that the sequence in which you do it will become more and more rigid. That turns out actually not to be the case, depending how it's organized. But for instance, like a lot of people, I have the same thing for breakfast essentially every day, but there are a lot of different things to do. And because I was in this kind of work, I started keeping observational diary of it. And that drew my attention to the way that so many of the actions I do for breakfast are actually triggered by others. So I know the kettle's boiled when I hear it click off, not because it's always exactly the same number of microseconds each day. I lay the table, look at the table, what's missing, and that tells me what I still have to do. And the errors I still make are associated with when the feedback actually isn't visible. So my oven loves it. Light's broken, so if I forget to put the plate on to heat, the cooked breakfast ready and the plate is cold still. So in fact, it seems that even highly practiced actions are associated with lots, typically organized as lots of little perception action rules. And the order in which they fire is to do with the environment. It's not to do with my memory of the sequence. And I think flow can be thought of as it's to do with those activities for which we have well-practiced perception action rules. And that's why we never are short of an activity. But it takes a while, an undetermined amount of time, I'm not saying it's a huge amount of time, but an undetermined amount of time to get enough rules on an area that you're more and more often able to operate for significant periods of time in flow without having to use your mind to generate a new kind of action. And there are, in fact, theories around which attempt to explain all of psychology in those terms. But I think flow is an area where, within our daily observation, if we choose to look, where this kind of approach makes a lot of sense. Yes, so I'll just do a little demo on you. Take a blank sheet of paper, and without cheating, in that dreadful way students have, they call it collaboration, but I know it's cheating. There's two things to see what you can get out of your memory. So the first one is, the building we're in is the Boyd-Orr building. As you approach it from QM side, this won't make so much sense to visiting students who may have only had a few days of practice, but many of the people in the room have had 4 years to practice this, and so this demo is whether in fact you've actually noticed anything about a building you use that's central to your career here, and yet you don't bother to remember things about it. So that's the first part. The second part is, and this should work for visitors as well as everyone else, in whatever version of Microsoft Word you use, at least I expect 90% of you use Microsoft Word, what can you remember about the items on the edit menu, which you almost certainly use every few minutes, every hour you're working? Okay. Any pictures of the Boyd-Orr? Quite. Actually, this is a demo I had at school, essentially. Still remember this, I suppose, age 10 or 11, where they got us to try and draw a postbox. And, of course, at that age, many of us had run out the post with for our parents, familiar with a postbox. And although we probably got the set of features on it right, we couldn't remember really basic things like, you know, was this label above or below the slit for the letters and stuff like that. This kind of demonstration is, I think, about how you can have a really routinized task without necessarily having a memory for parts of it, that the basis of our fluent action isn't actually conscious knowledge in many important ways, even though if I asked you this question at the moment where you could observe it, you know, it passes through your mind, but you just don't retain it if you... Well, first of all, you're most unlikely to retain things you don't use. But actually, the surprise is you don't retain things you do use if you can just pick up the information on the fly, perceptually. Right. Sorry about the left-hand screen. Sought after. But also, you probably have to say their states of no emotion. After all, if someone's not sort of... they're immersed in a task, they're not immersed in experiencing reactions to the task. So in many senses, flow is a state of low awareness. It's certainly a state of zero reflection, in my view. That is, you're not reasoning about what to do because you can always think of the next thing to try. But that has been objected to by an audience like you. And I think on the grounds that, of course, it's possible that reflection about something else might be, as it were, part of the task, just as I, you know, were trying to get you to recall something and draw a picture of it. That would make reflection of one sense part of what you're doing. I think another way of saying what I've been saying is that it's a state of not pre-planning stuff. So a rationalist view, which grips our society as a way we have of both holding other people to account and talking about our actions, often goes with a sort of assumption that we plan out what we're going to do and then we do it, and that the plan is part of us generating the action. And actually, that isn't true of how it's done mentally, I think, and flow is, as it were, exemplifies that doesn't mean you can't produce a plan that explains why you did what you did, but that's different from saying forming the plan is part of how you do it. So, you see, if you ask someone why they did something, most of the time we can produce an account that's reasonable. So it's not that we do things out of control, it's just that our thinking about those controls isn't normally part of how we generate actions. Otherwise, everything would be unbelievably slow, for a start. So, actually, just to take an extreme example of that little point about planning, it used to be the case that school teachers, more or less universally in the UK at least, would teach children to write essays by first writing an essay plan and then writing out the plan. And it was only after a considerable time and struggle that it became clear that only about half of people write essays by writing a plan. The other half, if they're bullied enough by teachers, will write the essay and then produce a plan to shut the teacher up afterwards as an account of why they did what they did, but not as part of producing it. And that is about half of people. That's not the bad half. It's a different way of going about writing. So that's just an illustration that the fact we can produce a plan, an accurate plan, a plan that's quite useful for judging something, doesn't prove that that's actually how you did the task in the first place. It can be, or it might have had nothing to do with it. It might be a post hoc account. So you probably have to think about that in a number of ways. So in court, if a witness is asked why they did something, they're obliged to produce a justification. And it doesn't mean they're lying, it just means that the justification they produce will most likely be a post hoc account. And its value is to do with how well integrated our minds are between the area that can do fluid action versus the area that monitors whether you're generating a skill in an appropriate way. And most of the time, of course, you do keep a reasonable amount of consistency between the two, so our post hoc reasons will be in line with everything else. But that doesn't mean it's part of the causal mechanism. Okay, John Dewey, famous name from 100 years ago in the education literature, had another of these graphs that I think has some relevance to flow. He had another account, and I drew the graph to illustrate this. So he talks here about slightly different contrasts. So enjoyment by the person doing it is going vertically, and realism in the sense of being related to external real-world tasks is going off to the right. So if you've got a tedious factory job, that's not enjoyable, but it's real work, you call that drudgery. Where we hope to be as professionals is in work that we enjoy a lot more. On the other hand, down here, what's play? Well, play is never as realistic as real work, but it can be enjoyable. And foolery, as when a schoolboy, example, a schoolboy, you know, pulling a piece of paper to bits while sitting, being bored by his teacher, is not even very enjoyable, as well as having nothing to do with a useful task. Incidentally, I was quite seized by his isolation of the idea of foolery, because the idea of play is very interesting, and there's a psychological literature. You can read a number of important psychologists on play, but there actually this is drawing attention to how things that you they typically only discuss play, which is likely to have a role in development, and don't have an account of why so many children, when they're bored, will do almost meaningless things that almost certainly aren't to do. You know, I'm not doing something useful, I'm not developing wonderful manual skills when I tweak my hair or shred a piece of paper or something like that. And I haven't come across an interesting psychological account of why that's not an uncommon human activity. So a related side issue is, what can we make anything of the notion of fun? I mean, maybe we can't. Not every English word has to have an academic meaning that's useful. But again, it's in this field of trying to make distinctions. And again, I'm repeating that Csikszentmihalyi is not going for flow that's not only intensely enjoyable but intensely serious in some in the sense that matters to the person doing it. Now, I'm just going to say a word or two about video games, of which I'm completely out of step with current culture, but I have a PhD student who's insists on that his topic is about video games and learning. So first of all, this is, in fact, these figures are now a few years out of date. It's probably more like 50% of adults by now will describe themselves as gamers when asked. It's of huge commercial and cultural importance. That is, the annual budget for world sales for computer games is far greater than world sales for Hollywood films, for instance. Much more important in making money. Much more important if you think about the number of hours a given person will spend on it, too. So the question is, what is the essence of what's engaging in video games? And what I'm coming to think is, contrary to the earlier literature, is that the big games, which absorb not only lots of consumer money but lots of consumer time, are about learning them. You know, when someone feels they've learned an entire game, that's when they stop and buy another one. And I think that's... I can't believe more people aren't paying attention to this, because that whole industry seems to be driven by the fact that, at least a lot of humans, have an intrinsic drive to learn stuff, even though it's completely useless, and will devote really serious resources out of their life to that, as if learning was enjoyable, whereas everyone knows from university, not the least enjoyable. So on the one hand, you know, as an educationalist, I find this very interesting, because in a way it could be read as a gigantic indictment of official education, that it fails to tap into what, when measured by these large sociological measures of time and money, appears to be a massive drive that the education system isn't at all skilled at tapping into. But here, it does require a little tweak to my attempts to extend the notion of flow, because video games are designed not to be easy to learn. That's the other thing. They're driven by people's desire to learn. And a naive person, if they read that as a definition, would say, right, well, I'll tell them the answer straight away. I'll be delivering the satisfaction quicker, wouldn't it? And of course, that isn't what's wanted. They want to learn in spite of the game. It makes it artificially difficult to learn, but possible, of course. And the question is, how could we describe that? And I think, therefore, have to tweak my attempts to produce definitions of flow, because, and this is based a bit on my student who's done a number of interviews and focus groups with experienced gamers in their 30s and 20s, the kind of things they talk about is indeed about strategies for learning, and about how, of course, there's low-level things, medium-level things, and great big things to learn, and typically a given gamer with a given game selects one of those levels and says that's their focus. They then will avoid spoilers about the answers on that level, but will think nothing of looking up spoilers about things that now bore them, like keystroke shortcuts and stuff. So their definition of cheating is to do with their goal, and they avoid it as spoiling their fun if it's at the level they're trying to operate at, and they'll use it without a thought if it's a means to that end. And I think probably the skill in computer games that become bestsellers is about achieving flow at learning. In spite of it being difficult, it's probably enjoyable to the extent that the gamer can always think about how next to try and find something out, and then they work away at following that up. So that's, I don't know if this is a good phrase, but why I say metaflow is they might be frustrated at the level of getting the information, but they're in flow at this level of how do I discover stuff in this game. And again, it will be subject to the sort of caveats before, that when someone's new to a game, they may be full of they may well face a lot of impasses full of frustration, but when they're getting into the middle of the game, they'll have a lot of strategies to use next whenever they need to find something out. And presumably, their pleasure is to do with rushing off to run this experiment, to make collaborations where other people will help them in a way that they find acceptable, and so on and so forth. So if year four university education was ideally designed, I would be capable of inducing in you this kind of metaflow, because flow by setting you puzzles which you didn't know the answer to, but were full of ideas about what to try next and so on. So to sum up on flow, I raised a number of possible different dimensions that are relevant to phenomena connected with flow. So there's the issue of enjoyment, skills, arousal level, the level of challenge for a given person at a given time. There's the relationship to the practical world. Now, video games usually don't make much of an effort there, but I think one thing you might like to reflect on is I don't know if any of you read any of this literature, it's not usually part of regular psychology, it would be more sociology, and that's how the institution of childhood has been invented and changed in our culture over the last few centuries. So in the 19th century, children were driven into factories. Philanthropic legislation eventually drove them out of it again and into schools. But the way in which childhood is still in some arguably dreadful nowadays is that people, and it's not just childhood, it's often a middle-class person like yourself, maybe 30 before you get to do anything much in the way of real work. And yet, when the economy was rural, a child would probably be contributing to the farm as early as 6 or 8, doing tasks that they could do at that age. I can still remember. Dad took us to a farm holiday, almost the first I can remember. I must have been about 8, and the cows got loose around milking time, and the farmer just grabbed me, completely unused to animals of any kind, and stand there and shoo the cows. Half-time beast, what am I supposed to do? Of course, the cows, he knew perfectly well, the cows wouldn't dare run me over, but didn't feel like that. So the point is that in, say, a rural economy, and in some cottage industries, children can contribute to what their parents are doing. They contribute something different. But the point is, the parent doesn't have to praise them because they can't help knowing that what they're doing is relevant to the most serious things in life. It's more meaningful than everything you do in school. So one way of looking at a serious, little-discussed problem in our educational institutions is we debar people for decades of their life from making a meaningful contribution to the society they're living in. And actually, and this is of course very relevant to positive psychology, most of us feel much better if we're sure we're somehow contributing to society. And that's not really about being idealistic, it seems to be something rather more fundamental in us. And on the whole, we cut children off from that entirely. We say it's exploiting them, we say it's too dangerous, and we cut them off from arguably one of the deepest wellsprings of normal human life and contentment. So when I say realism and allude to Dewey, I think that's the kind of argument about the connection with what society values. I'm sure the argument's much more complicated really than that, but I think it's more important than is often acknowledged. So here's another angle, much less pessimistic one. There's a very interesting Indian researcher in the education area called Saugata Mitra. And one of his projects, so Mitra comes from India, had a career as a research physicist there, and then got interested in education and did the first hole-in-the-wall experiment where, because his posh physics institute abutted the wall that walled off the Bombay slums, and he cut a hole in the wall, put an internet terminal there, and went away. So there was no help, there was an internet terminal, and what he observed is that kids would learn to use the internet, even though it's in a second language to them. They'd organise themselves and learn without any teachers at all. Of course, this is very threatening to professionals like me. The next thing, the thing more relevant here, well, one of the next things he did is he since set up a project which paired young Indian school children in typically in rural areas where the educational resources in India are the worst, with grandmothers he'd hired in from Gateshead in England. And this, and what he was examining really is what role teachers or adults have in education. So he says the role of an Indian grandmother, and that's probably much more evident in a rapidly developing society, is really to give unconditional regard to the child and praise them for what they're doing, even though they probably have no idea what the child is doing at school, which all parents suffer from a bit, but albeit it's most extreme in a developing thing. And it'll be even more extreme for someone from a different culture. But nevertheless, he's, as it were, isolated in a rather pure form, the way that it makes a big difference to a child, whether they feel that what they're doing is sort of somehow socially approved of and valued. Independent of all the other aspects of it, that's important to children, makes a significant difference to their learning. So again, that would be, in some way, in my mind, that's related to how children, one of the value dimensions, I think, for children and learning. Okay, so it's getting towards the end. So, your homework for the next week in this course, I'll put the slides up tomorrow, but it would be wise for you to make a note. So, number one is type up as a group at least a few brief notes on what you take from your wiki critiquing when you've finished the discussion in your own time. Two, there's an online questionnaire at that website, and I've also got that link on the main webpage for the course. There's a there's a positive psychology topic about strengths, and this is a self-assessment, free self-assessment questionnaire, and if you do it for yourself, that will make the lecture about strengths a bit more real to you. And thirdly, of course, get cracking on your group work, deciding if you're going to stay with a suggested topic, completely change it, redefine it, whatever. So the handout today was a supplement to the handout last week, gives you a few more details about the group work and the timetable and so on. And lastly, I've, as some of you may have already discovered, I've got the Moodle site for this course more or less up and running, and you can go into it. There's a link to it from the top course webpage. At the top level, I've got in live links to your private wiki. If you change your topic, drop me a line and I'll redo the text and the link to match what you want. If you go into group 5, you'll see a page like this, almost blank, but you, but nobody else, will be able to edit it. This annoying title here is meaningless, and I don't know how to get rid of it, but Sarah says she'll get a colleague to do it as soon as he's back from sick leave, so it might be a couple of weeks. But I hope to get rid of that. But basically, there's a simple editor that you can mess about with. I haven't yet updated the documentation on it, although you're quite likely to be able to do it without documentation. But if you find anything written by me on how to edit in Moodle, it's likely not to be completely accurate till I've had time to update it. And there's also a forum which is meant to work so that when you as a student go into it, anything you post will be seen by all your group and no one else, and will also be forwarded as emails to, I think, to members of that. So that's what I wanted to mention. Any last questions?